the Institute of Technology in Surabaya about a year and a half ago recommended a program. This was a study sponsored by the Asian Development Bank in Manila. They recommended the development of further development of a new Institute of Technology.
Oh, I see.
Building a whole new campus. Mm-hmm. And we are being invited to negotiate to provide academic support, become a linkage university, and the rest of it.
Along with the economic department.
And they never appreciate that it's helpful to have some advance notice on that.
If you've got your visa.
When you come out. Not yet, but we're getting them.
Yeah.
But we're expecting to leave Saturday. And,
is your wife going too?
She is going with me.
I've spent 3 years there. So
did you?
Yes.
Where in Indonesia?
Well, a year in Jakarta and then 2 years in Bandung. Bandung. My husband's in Indonesian history. So.
Oh. Well, that's very interesting. You've been to Surabaya? Or not?
Yes. It was very hot when we were there. But
well, we're leaving Saturday, and I expect we'll be there. We're supposed to be there. They wanted us Monday, and we couldn't really make it, so we're going to start Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And we run into the holidays at the end of the month of fasting.
I see. Oh, well.
And so it will delay things. And it's a very poor time to be away. All of our people, we thought this would happen last spring, early summer. All the people that are going to be on the program have now had to make plans about this semester. They're badly behind their schedule. It's a five-year loan. It was originally conceived as a 10-year program, and so they speeded it up and cut the budget back. So they're trying to redo a lot of things.
Wow.
And so I'm somewhat ill-prepared, and because they're late, they don't want us to delay coming. But it would be much better if we had another 2 weeks here in preparation. Better for them, too.
Things do seem to work that way, though.
But that's okay, yes. Well, you're interested in some of the history of the teaching assistants.
Well, not just that. That's just an entryway. I've been talking to a number of people in LNS about the consequences in the various departments of the big expansion of the university, and the TA strike was a symptom of and a result of that. And then what happened when the money stopped coming in and the students. And I wondered, want you to talk about how the College of Engineering was affected by, or whether it went through the same process. And I know you came in 1964, and whether you had a big wave of hiring in the 60s, and whether this has created problems, as it has in LNS, and then specifically about the TAs, do you use them in the College of Engineering?
Yes, teaching assistants are used in nearly all the departments, and they are an important part of our teaching program.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a different situation in our college than in the College of Letters and Science, in that most graduate students in the College of Engineering have some sort of financial support.
Mm-hmm. This was true in the chemistry department, too.
Yes, yes. Now, since we have a lot of research assistantships, then there is a different approach with the teaching assistantships. They're not quite so critical in the sense that people are not under the financial pressure in all instances, the teaching assistant. So we have a number of people, and traditionally have had a number of people that had small fractional appointments as teaching assistants. A student coming, for instance, with a National Science Foundation Research Fellowship, the so-called NSF Graduate Fellowships, might have also worked as a teaching assistant part-time maybe a 8th appointment or 6th appointment, instead of a third or half-time appointment, mm-hmm. which is required if a student is really going to be self-supporting. And it was used as a kind of a supplement and to give people teaching experience. Mm-hmm. Or they might be a teaching assistant one semester or two semesters, quarter time, and research assistant quarter time in mm-hmm. order to do that. So it was split up more in most departments would follow that pattern. Mm-hmm. Also, the teaching assistant worked very closely with the professor in the kind of a one-to-one relationship. Instead of having a large number of teaching assistants handling perhaps 20 sections of a course under the direction of one professor, you'd have one professor with maybe two or three teaching assistants. So this is a different relationship. I think that they regarded themselves more as students and less as employees than the teaching assistants did in other parts of the campus.
And did they handle a whole course themselves or just a...
No, they are assistants. They don't...
So they never have a whole...
They don't handle a course. And this is a matter, I think, college policy. It varies a little bit from department to department. The responsibilities aren't the same in all cases.
I wondered about that.
But it's...
Is this because...
It is regarded... They are regarded as teaching assistants, not as... lecturers or as instructors.
So you don't...
It's pretty carefully handled that way.
There isn't this sort of, as in German or French, where they, the TA then has the whole course. You don't depend on them.
There may be instances in the college you could find like that, but rarely.
Tell me something. Are beginning math and the chemistry courses that a chemical engineer needs, are they taught? Oh, I know the math courses are taught in the math department.
And all the science courses are taught in the science departments.
They are.
So yes.
They
teach this all is a matter of national policy in engineering education. In the accreditation of engineering colleges, it is believed that an engineer should learn his science from in the science departments, and he should learn his engineering in the engineering schools. Mm-hmm. So you have basic science courses in math, which are traditionally taught in the math and science. It's been this way for a long time, and it's also a matter of the accreditation practice of the profession to keep this way. They don't really think that engineers ought to be taught only by engineers.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same way with the courses in the required courses in humanities, which engineers have to take.
I was going to ask you about that later, but if that's, I notice you require 15 credits in of.
Yes, the and again, this is this was a matter which was established in the 40s, late 40s, early 50s, I believe, by the Engineers Council for Professional Development, which is the accrediting agency for engineering colleges, mm-hmm. that engineers should be trained in the humanities. And so they instituted a requirement of about one, the equivalent of about one semester's work in these fields.
Mm-hmm.
And these are defined as humanities courses. So this is a requirement in all accredited programs. It does not include, for instance, courses taught by the business school, but would include economics. Would include economics. It's it would not include the social studies type thing or social work, but it would. But it would include similar things.
It would
include history, political science, economics. But those things which mm-hmm. are listed on our campus by the letters, College of Letters and Sciences, meeting the humanities needs of that college. So these courses must be taken there, and they cannot be taught for instance, we could not develop courses in the engineering college which would meet that requirement, even though we might have courses relating to the ethics of engineering practice or the history of engineering. Unless these courses were also listed by the College of Letters and Science, they wouldn't count as our humanities credit.
Let's just make sure.
Was this decision made to help engineers think better, or was it to have something to do with their attitudes toward their work? I mean, in the sense of think better. Well, just...
I would give my personal view of this, but I think one held by a lot of other people. And that is that engineering has traditionally worked in technical areas, but not in science areas. But rather it, as I was taught when I first went to engineering school, that engineers were those people that used science for the benefit of mankind. So the idea that engineers worked only with machines is one which the general public may hold, but not one which engineers have held. But there was a recognition that the engineering curriculum had become so full that it was probably time to ensure that all engineers are at least exposed to things in the humanistic areas as a way of ensuring that they had background, formal coursework in these areas. Now, this is not, you know, 15 credits, of which may be scattered through two or three disciplines, does not ensure that a person is educated in these areas, but at least may introduce him to it at a level beyond high school, which is the way it had been done before. And it may then enable him through his own reading in his continuing education and his professional development in his profession to better understand and better work with people that were not trained in a scientific way. So the engineer has always believed, to some degree, I think, or at least hopefully he has, that he was working with people, not just working with machines. And this is an attempt to better equip him to do that. That was the idea. And it's an old development.
Yeah.
You inquired earlier about effects of enrollment and whether our college had a great expansion in size. Enrollment in engineering is cyclic, and it follows the concept of opportunity for employment that high school students have. So that if you look back since 1950, the enrollment has been up and down about every 10 years in a cyclic way, hitting a peak in 50 and in 60 and perhaps in 70, going now through another rising again. That is, the size of the graduating classes were maximum about those years. In 1950, we had large classes graduating and some problem with students finding immediate employment, our graduates finding immediate employment, because the business community, having a similar 10-year cycle, was down in the trough. So at that time in the 70s, because people had, or in the 50s, because people had some difficulty getting jobs, we had low freshman classes of enrollment. Now the average student spends about 5 years going through our program, so the low enrollment in the 50s resulted in a small graduating class in 55. Yeah. And by 1955, the business community was very active in trying to hire at a high rate. And so by 55, when we had the smallest classes, we had the maximum demand for them. And so the freshmen flocked in, and by 60, when they graduated, the demand was down, and we repeated this. And this is a serious problem.
So it's not connected, so it's not the same sort of swing as
yes,
what gets
and
the
our enrollment currently, even though we are back up and have been growing very rapidly because of the demand, heavy demand for engineers currently, we're still graduating small classes, although the size of the graduating class is increasing. The demand for these students has brought in a large number of freshmen.
Yeah.
But we still are not above the levels of post-war. So we do not have a college which has experienced the tremendous growth that the rest of the campus has since 1950.
In other words, you were at a low point in 1965 with about there.
Yes, about there. Well, no,
no,
we were at a high point,
about
65.
Then you were
Expanding rapidly now, and graduate or enrollment in engineering colleges across the country has been, in freshman class, for instance, has been growing at a rate of maybe 20% a year for the last several years. Now, this year, our freshman class did not go up above last year. It's probably about the same size as last year in the freshman. But the total enrollment in the college is up. Another phenomenon which we have, which makes it difficult to talk about size of classes, is that about half the students that graduate in engineering on this campus started somewhere else, either in one of the other units of the University of Wisconsin system, mm-hmm. or in some other state, and then transfer in at the sophomore or junior year. We've designed our programs to enable the student to do this fairly easily. And so it's possible for a student to go closer to home or in a smaller campus and take his basic science math there, and then transfer to Madison for his professional courses and his engineering courses and get his degree here. This is a good plan, but it and helps the students. But it results in us not knowing, for instance, what size our sophomore and junior classes are going to be, based on what's on the size of our freshman class.
Except so, by this swing that you've come to expect.
Well, yes. And now we are seeing some other trends currently in engineering education, which I think are healthy. We're seeing a large number of women entering engineering. I believe that our enrollment is over 10% women now in college. This is very unusual. It used to be 30 years ago we might have one or two women in the college.
They still don't go into math very much, but they've decided they can handle engineering.
Yes. We've also had a number of transfers from letters and science into engineering in the last two or three years.
That would be connected with the environment.
Out of the science. No, I think it's connected with the opportunity for employment.
Oh.
And I think the difficulty of science graduates having finding employment, and the greater ease with which engineers have found it, has led people to reassess their opportunities. I believe that there's been a trend throughout the whole university in turning toward education which is more occupation or, or profession oriented. This kind of thing. We've had a large minority effort in the minority program in the college in recent years, and I believe it's an outstanding program. But we are now getting blacks and other minority peoples into the college. This is a national problem in that there are relatively few minority people in the engineering profession.
It's because
and
of
so there's no ways to find educated, qualified minority professionals to teach or to practice engineering. But this has been changing. Mm-hmm. Engineering is a curriculum which requires a careful high school preparation for guaranteed success. The student really has to have taken his math mm-hmm. and ought to have taken basic sciences in high school
in order to
handle mm-hmm. this kind of thing.
Well, let's...
I guess we have had a lot of... You ask also about hiring of professors. We have hired a number of young professors. And there were quite a few professors hired in the 50s. I came here in 1964, having had 15 years industry experience. But there are a lot of people, a lot of professors in the same general age group that I'm in, which indicates that a lot of them came into the profession about the same time.
Well, and there were nine on the chemical engineering faculty in 1956. Was there a big wave of hiring in the 60s here as there was... I didn't check a catalog, I should have, in the 60s.
There has been in chemical engineering, which I'm more familiar with because I was in that department, there were a series of hirings through the 50s and 60s and even now in the 70s. So that's a department which has brought some people along and it has some people retiring in the next year or two. So there's been a very major turnover in that department, or will be by the before the end of this decade.
But you haven't been faced with the problem of a much too big faculty hired to handle an enormous inflow of students and then suddenly finding yourself with them.
No.
I see.
Currently, we are very, I would say most departments are pretty tight because of our this rapid expansion in enrollment. Now the students take the courses in engineering starting in the sophomore, but more in the junior and senior year. So our big freshman classes are now moving into that period. So this particular year, the college is very tight on faculty, and because of the budget limitations, we have reduced the number of teaching assistants we have in some instances. So,
are you free to hire more faculty, or do you are you restrained?
None of the department, none of the colleges are.
If this applies in engineering too.
You don't really have any money to pay them.
I see. So you had to vie for money with L&S and agriculture.
Yes.
I thought maybe you might have some other sources of money for.
We do. We have sources of money which fund our graduate programs.
But not for faculty.
But and we have some faculty who have been hired on non-state funds. But this is a very dangerous practice, and you try to avoid it because you're then faced with a situation of keeping these people.
Yeah.
And our graduate programs are funded to a very large degree with money obtained off the campus.
Yeah.
It's possible to do this, and so we have our research programs, research projects, which we believe should involve graduate students. And those are funded externally. But I think it would be unfortunate if we got too much of our staff on so-called soft money.
Well, that's been a problem wherever it's happened.
And if you do that, of course, you then employ faculty to do just research, because that's what you get the money for. You don't get the money for teaching. And so that really doesn't help very much with the undergraduate teaching program, teaching loads. It does enable you to have a greater graduate program. You can have more graduate students. But we have a good many more graduate students than we did in, I believe, in the 50s. But you have to look at the records to see that. I don't keep these statistics.
Okay. So your faculty does all teach at least an undergraduate course? You don't have people who are just...
No, our faculty all participate in the undergraduate and graduate program, with the exceptions that you find in any group.
But that's the practice.
We believe that it is desirable for a faculty person to have a research program, to do graduate teaching, and to do undergraduate teaching. And we encourage people to do this. We think that working with graduate students in research keeps the professor out at the front and keeps him alive and generates new information. This new information is then brought into graduate courses and refined. And then, because the professor teaches the undergraduate level, this results in material being gradually fed into the undergraduate course and keeps the curriculum up to date. Now, it's true that to some degree, every sophomore needs to know the same things that every other sophomore needs to know. But these things change, and particularly in a technical field with rapid change, it's necessary to do this. We also believe that engineering should be related to industrial practice and to the practice of engineering professionally. So we encourage people to participate in professional societies, to do things of a public service nature, to work with government agencies, local, state, federal.
Yeah.
And to also maintain contact with industry through consulting arrangements.
Well, I'd like to get into that
this
later.
Kind of thing.
I mean, that's
all right.
I think that
we can get into that.
But
this is, you know, the part of the philosophy of the college as to how these things are done. So another thing which people are expected to do is to have some kind of what we would group into the general title of public service activities or professional activities.
I guess that's true throughout the university.
I think so, but I don't know how you do this in a in the classics department, for instance. Maybe they work with libraries. I don't know.
Well, maybe they're just with the community welfare fund. I think, you know, it
yes,
would be an
that
unrelated.
Kind of thing. Yes. But I was thinking of things really related
of,
to
yes,
to what a man is teaching and what he expects his students to know and how he brings information back into the classroom.
Yeah. Now, do you want to start talking about the build up of the TA strike and your own involvement in the committee, or do you?
Oh, sure. I could tell. I could go back and start how I got involved in this. When there was first developed on the campus the Teaching Assistants Association, it was largely in outside our college. Mm-hmm. Although we had teaching assistants, we didn't have anyone particularly interested in the Teaching Assistants Association, as far as we knew. But they were looking for some faculty members, people to be on a committee to work with first the election of teaching assistants and this kind of thing. And I had experience in industry as chief engineer of a chemical company and had some interest in labor relations because I used to sit on the committee that negotiated contracts in our company and did this kind of thing. And also the teaching assistants are graduate students. I was involved with the graduate programs of the college through the engineering experiment station, and it seemed like I was a logical representative for our college.
Did you, I mean, who knew that you were, were interested in labor?
The dean knows these things and knew about those things. And it also seemed appropriate to have people from different areas of interest on the committee from the university, not all from one area.
You know, is this the same, this was the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on Teaching Assistant Association?
Yes.
So this is not the same thing as the Council of Ten, then?
No.
Or that presumably... Or
I don't even remember the Council of Ten.
Oh, you will when
number.
I remind you, I'm sure. On Teaching Assistant Association.
Yes.
So this is not the same thing as the Council of Ten, then?
No.
Or that presumably...
I don't even remember the Council of Ten.
Oh, you will when
number.
I remind you, I'm sure.
Oh, the Chancellor had a committee, and I was asked, somebody mentioned my name to the Chancellor, and so he said, sure, we have an engineering representative, and my general background in this area seems like it's appropriate. You know, not very many people worked in this kind of areas around a university, unless you're in industrial relations or business school or something of that sort. Although Dean Ratner in industrial engineering also works as an arbitrator and things like that. Somehow my name got up and I got on the committee.
I see. Would have been, do you remember when? 60? So
whenever the whole thing started.
The actual negotiations started in the spring of 69, and when the Chancellor recognized the TAA.
Yeah, this was about when it happened. Yeah. You know, it might have been the fall of 68 or sometime, I guess my files might show. But it seemed to me that although there was a group of teaching assistants who were interested in forming a teaching assistants association and had one. They didn't have very many members and wasn't very much interest in it until after one of the campus demonstrations when the legislature was in session and the legislature passed a bill. Eliminating out-of-state tuition. This was to eliminate the out-of-state tuition remission for teaching assistants. Mm-hmm. And Governor Knowles vetoed this so that it never became law. But in the intervening period, this would have been a tremendous financial blow to the teaching assistants. So those in the union or in their association got a lot of members to sign up. And they saw this then as a serious external threat, in my view, and I think we have a Teaching Assistants Association today because of that action by the legislature. Because this then gave them a reason, and brought it, we might have gotten it eventually anyway over some other thing, but certainly that got enough interest in it. And then with the election, the first election to set up the association because of this interest. They've got enough students, they've got enough people. Now, there was not widespread interest by teaching assistants in schools like engineering and agriculture and other places, so a lot of them didn't even vote. A few departments did get out and vote, with the idea that if you don't want a union, you better vote. Same as if you do want one, you better vote.
Do you know?
And I think there was one of the departments in which the engineer mechanics department voted a majority to affiliate with TAA. And so they have a departmental unit. I'm not sure whether any other engineering departments have voted. I was in chemical engineering at the time, and they voted against it.
Do you think there was any faculty pressure here, or was it just student disinterest? Any faculty pressure against joining?
Oh, I'm sure there were faculty members who would have expressed a view contrary to organizing into a union. but I don't think there was very much talk about it at all. Mm-hmm. I think there was probably very low turnout. Mm-hmm. Most of, even those departments voted majority for it. That it wasn't really a majority, it was just a majority of those voting. Mm-hmm. And there were a few departments. I was aware of what was going on and frankly told our teaching assistants that if they didn't take a stand on this, why somebody else would take one for them.
And, so did they go and vote?
I don't know. I think they did. I think they did. At least they didn't go and vote for. I mean, there was not a, of those that voted, but I don't know. I don't remember the count, if I ever knew.
What was your own feeling about the TA? Did you think it was going to be...
Well, at the time, I did not think that it would serve the students very well.
The students, you mean, as against the TAs?
No, I meant the teaching assistants in it.
Okay.
The graduate student teaching assistants, mm-hmm. I did not think it would serve them very well. Mm-hmm. I saw it as a divisive thing, separating them and reducing them from a position of being colleagues with their research professors to one of being employees. Mm-hmm. And I did not think this was a desirable situation.
Were you aware of some of the conditions that they were protesting?
No, my experience was in the College of Engineering, and
but I mean on the L&S campus.
They did not have no, and I say I was not aware of the kinds of things which some of them were working under. In retrospect, you ask what I thought at the time. In retrospect, it seems to me that the Teaching Assistants Association has done some things which were important to have done, and which might not have occurred if they hadn't had some kind of an association. I feel that their association has had relatively poor leadership, particularly early.
Poor in the sense
that they were not that they were personally motivated to use the association for ends which I did not see as the appropriate goals for representing the teaching assistants. And they were most unprofessional in their relationships and their bargaining relationships, and have been from the beginning. This seemed to change this last year, my view. But, you know, there were some things happening which were important to have exposed to faculty and administrative view more broadly. I really think that was important. And that most of the things which are legitimate abuses, which once they were seen, were stopped, were changed. Now, you could say that this should have been done by the individuals going and presenting their cases and doing this sort of thing. But that hadn't happened. And so you can really argue that the association was a factor for good.
Oh, are you going to be specific? What are the things you have in mind?
No, I'm not going to be specific, but...
I don't mean naming names, but...
There is a relationship between a graduate student and a professor, which is a very strong control. And the student is, to a degree, at the mercy of a particular professor. And if this same kind of a relationship extends into a employee or an assistant relationship, then it can lead to expecting entirely too much work under certain circumstances, or in capricious or arbitrary behavior on the part of the employer in relation to a group like that. This kind of abuse, which occurred in many places, until the employees are forced, if it occurs, then the employees are forced to band together and form an association to do this. It's public policy, matter of public policy, to recognize unions in the country and to do this. It's still difficult to see how this sort of thing, whether this thing is the best way. I personally believe it's better to work these things out with individuals. But if it doesn't happen, then it will lead to a unionization and an attempt through force to redress or get attention to these grievances.
Do you think it was a matter of individuals or particular departments? That is, that you must have become quite familiar once you were on the Council of Ten.
There's a lot of variation from department to department, and but to talk about a department in which there are 50 or 70 professors as having a uniform or unified approach to a thing as complex as a professor's relationship to his teaching assistant, it's a little difficult. Mm. Certain practices in certain departments seem to be, you know, they developed that way. The way it had always been. Nobody had looked at why is it this way, and is it the same in history as it is in English and the language departments or in chemistry and other places. And you know, the university didn't have a very big personnel office in those days. There wasn't anybody who had a way of looking at those things. Teaching assistantships were regarded as stipends to help graduate students get through school, and it might be a real good thing if they were still regarded that way. It might be a more a closer relationship between professor and students with that kind of feeling. But in a sense, that's a paternalism, which is not in style. And as you go to the idea that many of the teaching assistants seem to have is, this is an employment. This is my job. This is the way I make my living, and I want to be a professional employee, and I want you to recognize me as an employee. And that is the basis of the contract or the agreement with the TA, that they are in agreement as employees. This is quite a different relationship, quite a different approach, philosophically.
Do you remember, can you remember what, which departments, in your opinion, were causing the most dissatisfaction among
the TAs? Dissatisfaction was, I wouldn't put it in causing. I would say that the greatest dissatisfaction occurred in those departments where there was the largest number of teaching assistants, where you had to deal with, and where people were not dealing on a close relationship, but where a professor might have a large number of teaching assistants, or where there were many more applicants than there were job openings, so that there were difficult decisions to make as to who got the jobs, the few jobs which existed. There was an opportunity to, or I say an opportunity because I don't know whether this was actually occurring or not, although people claim that it would occur and it could happen, that graduate students were brought here for 1 year as teaching assistants and then after they got committed into a program and got established, then they didn't get another teaching assistant. Well, I'm sure that, and so, but then they felt, well, I'm trapped here. I have to continue at Wisconsin. I can't really transfer and go somewhere else. Or, particularly after a couple of years, they do this. And then they take their teaching assistants and go off and use this to recruit more graduate students.
Yeah, I've heard this of the history department. I don't know.
Yeah, this is a kind of practice which was possible. I won't say that it occurred. I would say that it might have occurred in some instances. And yet you could say, well, that's a deplorable thing to do. This led to the guaranteed number of years of support and provision, which is in the contract, which was a response to that. Mm-hmm. Now, from the College of Engineering, this never occurred because we had support for most all of our students. Yeah. And a student didn't come, so this provision within the contract to guarantee support for a minimum number of years is no problem because it was always being done. It's a complex thing to administer. It results in a lot of paperwork and record keeping and a lot of other things. And it's, in a way, you can say, well, this is an unfortunate waste of our resources to do all this record keeping. And from the college's viewpoint, it is. I mean, from our college's viewpoint, it is. It doesn't change anything for the teaching assistants. It just means extra work. The minimum appointment provision is one which is aimed at the problem of students trying to use this as a way to support a family while they incidentally go to school. Maybe I'm being unkind in that kind of remark, but some of them look from the number of years they stay here and from the difficulty people or teachers were having in getting jobs in certain fields. It looked like a person, if he could, you know, stay a TA, even at half-time level, he'd be better off doing that than having nothing to do. And so it was possible to, perhaps not consciously, prolong educational programs beyond when they should be. It was nonetheless, that was a way of living. You didn't live very well, but you lived. You had something to do, and in your own field, instead of being forced totally out of them. So I think this resulted in a minimum appointment provisions in the contract, where you wouldn't gradually work a person down to a smaller appointment, or once you started them at a certain size appointment, you had to maintain it at that level. Now this doesn't help the teaching assistant in our college at all, because we didn't have that situation. Yeah. It wasn't that situation. It acts actually in a few instances contrary to the desires of particular students. We have students who would like to have a little teaching experience, but they're in a hurry to finish. Perhaps they have veterans benefits or source of income so that they will be going on through even though they don't have research assistantships. But they might like to teach quarter time or sixth time even, to get some teaching experience. A department might like to hire them.
Well, they can do it, can't they?
But they can't do it.
But you're not under the TA. You said
yes,
only one of the departments.
No, but you have to do this. This year, the provision says you can't have a person hired less than third time.
In the contract this year, you know, I haven't looked at that.
So this is the provision, which comes in from this kind of thing. And it shows how, in order to be sure that people are not improperly treated, you introduce things which maybe you don't always work.
That's quite unfortunate if it really was just one department. I think the math department, somebody said were always carried. If they got somebody as a TA, they had always kept him on.
And sometimes I can't help but feel that the teaching assistants bring up these things because they've heard from a few people organization and speak loudly about it. And they get insistent upon doing something, then you get it in. Oh, I believe we all have benefited in one way or another from unions, in that this has improved the general standard, but that it is, it's not a development that doesn't have some problems with it.
Do you think that it helped to put shed more attention on undergraduate teaching, the TA strike?
No.
You don't?
No. I think that this was an inappropriate use of their union, that it, and I think there were some teaching assistants, even some people on the committee that we bargained with, that were very sincere in what they were doing, but that, that this was a method in which whereby the Teaching Assistants Association was trying to generate widespread support for a strike.
You're talking about educational planning. Is that what you mean?
Educational planning, class size, undergraduate instruction, and the whole bit, the whole thing. All of these were ways in which they were trying to elicit sympathy of the undergraduate student, so that when they were ready to call a strike, the undergraduate student wouldn't go to class. And this then turns it into a much more effective way of interrupting the educational process. And that it was not truly in the interest of the undergraduate student. I don't think they can divorce their own interests from the issue, and that to a large extent it was developed for this purpose and misguided.
Interesting. So
I really believe
that even though
some of the people involved in it are sincere, as far as I am concerned, our teaching assistants are excellent teachers. By and large, I think they really are dedicated
the leaders of the strike teaching in the College of Engineering now in remedial math.
I imagine
he's a good teacher.
Henry Haslick, I think, who's his name, who you're talking about, is as near as I've ever heard anyone say, is an excellent teacher. Mm-hmm. And I've said this to him, too. But he was one of the very difficult people to deal with in the early days. I wondered what he was after.
Have you ever asked him, talked to him about it?
No. No. I think we gained an appreciation. I gained an appreciation of him, of what he was doing. The union has changed through goes through cycles. It's been had different groups at different times.
Have you been all along on the?
Yes.
I see. Well then.
Yes,
then
I'm the only one that has actually.
Then I've
been all the way through.
This is something we should go into. I have been concentrating on the 1970 events, and it's important to find out what did happen. Do you think we should stop now?
I think we probably should.
I have a feeling that.
This is side two of Dean Coberly's interview.
Now I'll ask you about your trip to Surabaya later.
The Department of Chemical Engineering is one of the medium-sized departments in the College of Engineering. It has a faculty of of actively involved people in the department of 17 or 18 professors. So this puts it about middle size. I suppose it's the third largest department, or fourth maybe largest department in the college. But a department of that size acts as a unit in the sense that the number of people is not so great that they can't still interact in a faculty meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So the faculty meetings are attended by most all of the people that are in the department.
How often are they held?
And they're held about every 2 weeks.
Has that been true for a long time, or has it changed?
And that's the pattern that it has had for a long time.
That's frequent, isn't it? Every 2 weeks.
Yes, but you only meet for about an hour and a half, and there's quite a bit of business if the department tries to act as a total faculty instead of working as subunits.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the business of the department is decided upon in a full faculty meeting,
mm-hmm.
of this kind of thing. The chairman, there is no fixed rule about how long the chairman serves. For many years, Professor Haugen and Professor Raggetts used to rotate the chairmanship back and forth between them periodically. They're quite different in their approach to administration of the department, but very compatible, so that they had different characteristics, and the faculty would switch them back and forth every 3 or 4 years, I suppose. So there had not been very many chairmen of the department. Professor Kowalki was the chairman for a great many years, and Professor Haugen and Professor Raggetts, and they'd switch back and forth. And after Professor Raggetts, Professor Byrd, R. Byron Byrd, was chairman for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I guess. Then I was chairman for, I've forgotten the name.
Was that when you first came?
No, I had been here for about 3 years, I guess. And I must have been chairman for about 4 years, 3 or 4 years. You'll have to look up the records to see why I can't remember.
You were elected.
Yes. Now, the chairmanship in all the departments, the chairman in all the university are appointed by the deans of the colleges, the academic deans, on the recommendation of the departments. So each year in our college, the dean asks the department professors to vote on who they want for chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And then they agree on who should be chairman, and the dean appoints them. This is done every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some departments have fixed rules about the maximum number of years that a person can be chairman. And chemical engineering does not have that. So it changes when the department wants it changed in chemical engineering.
Has there been any period when it made a difference how strong a chairman the department had? I mean, any period when there were problems that the chairman would have had to, or could have solved, or could not solve, or has it been a fairly
I think that the changes
department?
From one chairman to another in chemical engineering have, in general, been when the chairman wanted to change.
Mm.
Professor Byrd had been chairman for several years, and he decided that he wanted to go back into his research and teaching activities full-time and not have the responsibilities of department direction. And that's when I became chairman.
Mm.
And when I left the chairmanship, it was to become associate dean of the college, and then Professor Bowen became chairman. When he left the chairmanship, it was to go into the chancellor's administration office, and not so much because the department wanted to get rid of him, but the chancellor wanted him to go into that slot.
He was on the Merman committee, wasn't he?
Yes, and after that he was assistant vice chancellor, mm-hmm. or associate vice chancellor, I guess it was. And then Professor Stewart became chairman, but it has not been a case of the department getting upset with chairman and
seeking something else.
No. But that happens, you know. That happens from time to time in departments. But that wasn't the case here.
What I really meant was anything such as happened in some of the L&S departments where things came up that a chairman couldn't handle because he wasn't a strong chairman, or where his policies affected what developed. I'm not speaking of changing chairman, but I guess I'm saying, does the chairman have an important role, or has he had to play an important role?
Well, I think the early development of chemical engineering in Wisconsin was due to Professor Haugen and Professor K.M. Watson.
Yes, we have an interview with Professor Haugen for quite a long time.
Yes,
one,
so I'm sure you do. And this was through the middle history of the department. And so I think the fact that he was chairman was incidental in some respect. The chairman can have an important role in helping to bring in particular people.
Yeah, I think that's true.
For instance, Professor Haugen, I'm sure, was instrumental in bringing Professor Byrd to Wisconsin in chemical engineering,
mm-hmm.
and Professor Stewart and then Professor Lightfoot. And the three of them together, not when Professor Byrd was chairman, or when any of them were chairman, had a very important effect on chemical engineering education nationally, as well as at Wisconsin, through an introduction of a new textbook.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Through a new book. Their book on transport phenomena was introduced at a time when there was need for a change seen here. So mm-hmm. you could say that Professor Haugen had a great effect on chemical engineering education through bringing these particular professors to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But you don't do that through the administration of a department.
No.
When you think about problems in a department, I can express my views on this. I'm not sure these are facts at all. But it's my view that as departments get large, you get so many people that they can no longer meet together as an effective group, and they can no longer act as a unit, and so they start to fall into subgroups.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You can see this in departments in the College of Engineering. Civil engineering, for instance, is organized along lines of subdivisions of civil engineering. There's a group which is involved with sanitary engineering, hydraulics. There's a group with structural engineering, and a group with photogrammetry and surveying. Now, when that happens, you really have more than one department. And so they start to have interests which, while related, are directed toward particular goals, separate from the single goal as a group. I can see in a very large department, such as letters and science departments, mathematics, and even the bigger ones of history and English and some of those, where it would be impossible even to get all the faculty together for a single meeting. And so in those instances, I would imagine that they have to have a much more elaborate departmental organization structure than you have in chemical engineering.
Is civil engineering the biggest, by the way, of the...
Electrical engineering is the largest department in our college. But this was my point in saying that chemical engineering is a small enough group that it can meet with generally all the faculty there, and that it, while they can argue and have disagreement on things, because they can meet all together, they can still act as a unit and as a single department.
Yeah.
And of course, it's my belief that the department organization works well up to a certain size.
What size?
And maybe that size is around 20, or perhaps a little bit larger than that. But if it gets much larger than that, well, then subgroups start to form and they fall apart. And one of the important functions in a department like chemical engineering is to prevent, of the chairman, is to prevent the formation of isolated groups, which would keep the department from acting as a unit. And this is, I think this is necessary, that you want a unified program. You don't want half the group pulling in one direction and another part of it pulling in another, and so that you have these disruptive factors. Everybody has to know one another and have to work pretty much together. If the group gets too large, then this is extremely difficult. You really have then a group of departments which are banded together under the same name.
And only hold together when they're facing somebody else.
Well.
Do the non-tenured faculty as well as the tenured faculty vote on promotions and salaries? Or how is that handled?
All the members of the department participate in most activities. The executive committee of the faculty, which is of the department, which is the tenured members of the department, vote on promotions of assistant professors, and also are charged with salary recommendations. That's about the only thing. Promotion of associate, when you come to promoting associate professors to professor, even though they're all tenured, only the professors vote in that instance.
I see.
That's according to the university rules.
And do you normally get people in at the lower ranks, or an equal amount of time get in full professors? What is the pattern there?
I don't think you can generalize this. Most of our most recent appointments have been at the assistant professor level, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical engineering, for instance, brought in an associate professor this last year. When I came, I came as a professor.
Uh-huh.
So it varies with what the department is trying to do. I believe now that most departments, including chemical engineering, are trying to bring people in at the beginning age level so that they will get a better age distribution of faculty.
I was going to ask you about the age distribution now of the faculty.
It's not uniform the way you might like to think it should be. There are three professors that will be retiring in chemical engineering this year. Then there is a fairly large group of people in the late 40s and early 50s. And then there is a younger group of men who have just been promoted out of the associate professor group. And then a couple of younger ones. So they're kind of bunched rather than uniformly distributed. This is somewhat by chance, I guess, but it's you might wish that you would have them uniformly distributed so that they would move through. But most departments don't look like that.
Well, it's a small enough department. No, that isn't what I'm saying.
Well, if you had 20 people and you thought that the average length of time in the department was 40 years, it wouldn't be quite that much. Then you might say you'd like to hire a new person every 2 years and have someone retire every two years.
That'd be the ideal, wouldn't it?
But it doesn't work out that way.
Does the engineering college have a faculty senate?
No. No, it doesn't. Doesn't have a faculty senate, but the engineering college has and regular meetings as the entire faculty. They have faculty meetings, but they do not have a senate, which would be representative of the faculty. Every person is entitled and is expected to attend. The attendance is not nearly that high. This meets several. It may meet as often, if there is business to be conducted, it may meet each month. Mm-hmm. Usually it does not meet that often. We usually have about six or five faculty meetings a year during the academic year.
Does it perform any particularly important function, or is it just tending to, are there big issues that come up? And
well, there are functions which are specifically assigned to college faculty, which they have to do. They have to approve, and our college approves all course changes, all courses to be taught in the college, all curriculum changes and curricula. It approves all degrees to be granted, and from time to time it discusses a number of quite important issues, and if there are things of real interest to the faculty, why, we'll have large attendance. This follows a little bit after the pattern of the old university faculty meetings, when we had large faculty meetings.
So that the more...
Before the formation of the Senate.
There's a small and steadfast group that comes all the time.
Pretty much so.
The not for exciting things. You're having department reviews, presumably. I think that's a college-wide, university-wide requirement that the regents have asked for.
Yes, our college, as all colleges of engineering in the United States, well, most colleges of engineering in the United States, go through an accreditation procedure. This is performed by the Engineers Council for Professional Development. It's a national organization which accredits curricula in engineering.
Like the School of Social Work?
Yes, it's a similar kind of thing.
So you were doing this all along?
Normally we would be accredited every 6 years. We have just had an accreditation visit, and I believe that this will serve to some extent in lieu of the departmental reviews, which have been requested by the regents. We're expecting that this will substitute. This amounts to a review by outside reviewers,
yes,
rather than by inside people.
So it doesn't...
But yes, we'll be reviewed one way or another, everyone else.
Well, shall we move on to the TA strike?
If you'd like to.
The negotiating. You said you'd had some experience with labor unions when you worked for a chemical plant, and that was the reason you were put on the chancellor's TAA
committee.
It
may have been one of the factors in deciding that I was a suitable appointment, suitable person to be appointed to this committee.
Had you actually been to bargaining sessions?
Yes. I used to be in charge of an engineering department, and included in my responsibilities were the overall responsibility for operating the boiler plant and the utility system for a large chemical plant. So we had two unions in this boiler plant. The operators and maintenance men and the operating engineers were in two AF of L unions. And so I was a member of the group which used to negotiate the contracts, the labor agreements for these two unions.
So you had a good basis.
So I had been in a number of sessions for several years. I guess I was on that team for some 8 or 9 years.
You must have been the only one on the faculty negotiating committee that had any experience with a union. I can't think of anyone else who would have.
Well, there may have been some
Arlen
people.
Arlen Christensen, perhaps.
Arlen Christensen may have had in the first.
But team, as an
but
arbitrator.
Later, on later years, when Ed Krinsky was there, he'd had a great deal of experience through his work.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the 1970 strike to begin with.
I might have been the only one.
Well, how would you compare them?
Well, this was very different. The teaching assistants were not organized with any experience in this kind of thing. And so their goals were very different from the goals that I had seen in a labor union, where you were dealing with people who were in a stable situation. They had been employed for a long time in their jobs. They expected to be employed a long time for their jobs, and they were interested in bringing about certain changes, things they really wanted. Most of them were related to wages or fringe benefits, some minor things related to working conditions or work rules type things. But they were not trying to bring about organizational or structural changes in the institution or the company they were in. They were not working on philosophical or ideological points of any kind like this. There was not the feeling that they were trying to work off anger against anyone, and I thought there was a great deal of that in the early negotiations. That people, and also they had a very firmly organized union. You knew that that when you were dealing with their bargaining groups, you were dealing with people who, if they didn't speak for the whole group, they at least could act for the whole group.
And you had doubts
about
that.
The Teaching Assistants Union were very different in my view.
Did you feel their goals were clear cut, or were they working them out as they went along? Did they change them? There was a great deal of negotiating, months of it, and I wondered how well prepared the TAs who were bargaining were. Were they up on the?
It seemed to me that they were interested in bringing about fundamental changes in the university and in the university system, and that they were not particularly interested in improving the financial lot of the teaching assistant, that they were very angry
Now you're talking about the negotiators now.
Yes. So they were not really acting in a way you would expect a union to act. It was very difficult to know what they really did want, to find out what they wanted, and they were asking for a lot of things which nobody could give to anyone. And so this made the negotiations very slow. They were extremely, I would term it, abusive of and personal in their bargaining.
Abusive toward the everybody?
Of the bargainers. That there was a great deal of vicious language and talk. Conditions which I, from my industry situation, would have resulted in immediate stoppage of all negotiation.
Really?
Oh yes, we would have never tolerated anyone acting that way in negotiations. There was a firm set of rules that if people could not be gentlemanly and constructive in their discussions, recognizing that there would be no displays of anger and this kind of thing, well then things would be adjourned until such time as people were ready to deal in an adult manner.
Why didn't the university have such rules?
I wondered this. I was not in charge of negotiation. But you see, we were not dealing with an experienced group of people. We really were dealing with some of our students, and everyone, I think, had a kind of combined feeling or mixed feelings about what we were doing. But there were many times when I felt that we would have been totally within reason to refuse to, well, just to tolerate that kind of action. We had no intention, we had no desire to have a strike, we had no desire to destroy the union as such or upset this, and so we just tolerated a great deal of things which would not in a normal bargaining session situation have existed.
Well, how did it come about that it was tolerated? There must have been others who agreed.
Oh, I don't know.
Did you discuss
it
among yourselves?
No, not greatly.
You and what, Doremus, Bucklew, Christensen, Lauren? You didn't.
No, we didn't really. We didn't really discuss this.
Why not?
Well, this pattern had been established. It was going on before I was in the group. And I didn't see any point I didn't think there'd be any way to bring about a change in this kind of thing. And we were not intending to break off negotiations or stop. It was easier just to go ahead with it. This same kind of pattern continued for a good while, and for several years.
I gather from what you say that it doesn't exist now.
It did not this last year.
Mm-hmm.
Not nearly to the. Well, it hardly existed at all. People rarely had anything which you would think was abusive or anything, but. Very professional kind of bargaining type thing.
But this might have been due to the inexperience of the people who were initially on the bargaining committee, that they wouldn't realize that this wasn't always a part of bargaining to be insulted. It makes me wonder.
Oh, I wrote it up to inexperience and also the times. and the anger that they had against many things.
Were they indiscriminately abusive, or did they single out particular members of the university?
Oh, they had their favorites.
Who were their favorites?
Well, I didn't engage in this kind of thing with them very much, so I escaped a fair amount of it. I decided that I would not say things which I was sure would make them angry. I saw this as serving no purpose.
I
did not hesitate to express my views, but on the other hand, I would not take up a challenge for a verbal argument.
I
did not hesitate to express my views, but on the other hand, I would not take up a challenge for a verbal argument for argument's sake.
I know I read through the minutes last night, and I noticed that you were very—you were always talking about facts when you were. You seemed to be when you spoke.
This was easy for me because we're kind of remote from the central problems in engineering.
Yes.
You know, we're a little bit off the center of the campus.
You must have felt
a bit
superior, did you?
Oh, I don't think superior. I think maybe fortunate.
Uh-huh.
No, and. It was easier because we had not been involved in a lot of the controversies at the department level that some of the other departments had.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought for a while that Professor Doremus or Dean Doremus was a particular object of their scorn or their questions, and he saw no reason, and rightly so, not to set the record straight when somebody made a wrong accusation, this kind of thing. And so this leads to this kind of pointed arguing.
Well, what about Buckley? What was your judgment of him? He was, after all, the chief or the business negotiator. Especially since you can compare him to Krinsky.
I don't remember him very well. I don't have any strong feelings about him in this regard.
I suppose the question is, with different
see, you know,
people, would the thing have turned out differently?
Oh, who can ever say about that? I suppose with different people on either side, it could have turned out differently.
Well, I meant on the university
yeah.
side.
But, no, I think we probably came to about the same position that any group, given the particular constraints, might have come to. There was one thing which went into that first settlement, which we might wish hadn't gone in. The class size limitation was about the only thing which went in, which has been a prolonged source of difficulty. This was a compromise which resulted in a settlement of the first strike. And you might ask the question as to whether or not it would have been better to have just prolonged the strike and not given on that particular point. There's no way to answer that question to know what the result would have been, and certainly the people that that made the decision regarding this at the time it was made felt that that was the best thing to do. And there's no way of knowing whether it was or, you know, there's mm-hmm. no point in trying to speculate. But that has been one thing which has been a problem. It was the problem this last year over attempting to change this.
Before getting back to the actual negotiations, you spoke of the TA negotiators as being angry and abusive. Do you distinguish among them? There were Marchetti and Jim Marchetti and Hank Haslack were the principal ones, and then there was Paul Schillart and Dave Burris.
Dave Burris. They were all pretty much alike. They each had their own talents. Henry Haslack is still active in the TAA.
Yes, yeah. I've interviewed him, as a matter of fact.
It's been interesting to see Henry's change.
Has he mellowed?
Oh, that's probably as good a word to use as any. He is... he's maybe a little more restrained. It's things are just a different style now.
Well, as you say, times are different.
I admired all of these people for their skill. They were all very intelligent, and mostly I think they knew what they were doing.
Oh, I see. You felt they were well prepared and
felt they had a purpose in what they were doing. Well prepared, I don't know about that. I don't know how you can be very well
prepared.
Were they
clever
at
picking up inconsistencies
they weren't always very consistent in what they were doing and this kind of thing. I don't think they were inconsistencies. I don't think
University
presented an inconsistent point. Hmm. And this kind of thing. I think that the university had a very relatively simple kind of thing they were presenting, and it's not the sort of thing where you're trying to trick anybody or make anything of this. So it's not a matter of inconsistency so much that they would pick up. They were articulate.
Did you enjoy the meetings?
That kind of activity is exciting and stimulating. It's very tense. You recognize that it's a very serious matter.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there's a certain amount of enjoyment in it. It's not the sort of thing which you would... that I would choose to make my life's work.
Fortunately, you don't have to. I'm
not a labor negotiator. This is not my field of work, and
I would imagine these sessions were more entertaining than the ordinary labor.
I never regarded them as entertaining.
Oh, you didn't?
Oh, no. They were highly frustrating. You'd go to a session for 2 or 3 hours, and you are you're totally exhausted. You're unable to think creatively about other things.
You mean because of being tired and
wrong? Mentally tired.
Yeah.
Just mentally tired. And particularly when you are when you're trying to really reach agreements. This is extremely hard work for someone who, I think it's hard work even for people who do it as a full-time occupation. Mm. And particularly the early sessions, you're continually under pressure to not lose your temper when you're being deliberately provoked.
Yeah.
This kind of thing. No, this is a very difficult session.
Was Jim Marchetti
different from the others? Did you feel that he had a different approach or different goals? Or
well, Jim was, of course, a graduate student in industrial relations.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had had training and was skillful in these techniques. And I was always sorry to that he left the university without completing his degree. He would have been a very skilled labor negotiator, and I think it was too bad that he didn't go ahead and finish instead of leaving. But you know, they all were pretty bright young men, and I thought it was too bad that he didn't do that. He was one of the leaders in the group, took a leading position in the negotiation.
You were expected to communicate the progress to the rest of the College of Engineering. Was there interest here? There were John Hoops, is it? How do you say his name?
John Hoops.
And Arthur Tiedemann and Miller Johnson were the channels through whom you were to spread information.
I would report back as it seemed appropriate or necessary, either to the chairman through the dean's executive during the dean's executive committee meeting, or through other people.
Mm-hmm.
And people used to call me and ask questions about things. And,
were they concerned about it here on the engineering campus?
Oh, they were very interested in it and concerned, in a sense that they wanted things to go well, and they wanted, but they didn't have the immediate concern that people in departments where the teaching assistants were unhappy and were about ready to walk out on strike and this kind of thing.
Except mechanical engineering, you said, did have a majority of, or did.
No, I don't think it was mechanical. I think industrial engineering.
Oh, industrial engineering.
Industrial engineering had a majority of their people, and engineering mechanics, I think, had a majority of their
engineering
people.
Engineering mechanics.
Voted to join.
Why would
join
that be?
The union? But I don't think they were really interested in going out on strike. It's hard to understand why a department teaching assistants voted for it. I believe in that particular group, they had a relatively low turnout, and those that were in favor of it managed to get those people that were in favor of the teaching assistants to go and vote, and the others didn't bother.
Hmm.
And so that a minority of the department voted and carried the election,
yes,
carried the other group. This is what always happens when you don't pay attention to your own affairs and stand up and be counted.
Has this affected these departments? They've had to have
to a minor
the evaluations
degree, to a minor
and,
degree, not greatly. The college generally, the faculty of our college, generally took the view that let's get rid of this union. Let's get it. If they want to go a strike, let them go ahead and strike, and we'll get somebody else to do the work. This kind of thing, you know, militantly conservative view of this
more
kind
than
of
LMS.
Thing. Oh, much, I presume much more so. I don't know, but you see, our college in practice would have been much less disrupted by a strike than the other departments, because we don't use so many teaching assistants, and also because most of our teaching assistants would not go out on strike,
yeah,
even if the rest of the union struck. They felt they weren't members of it, they didn't belong to it, they weren't going to
They didn't identify with the group.
No, they didn't. They weren't. And I think that's probably still a feeling if this were to occur.
Yeah.
Even this last time, I don't think any of the teaching assistants in the College of Engineering went on strike.
Did any go on strike in the 1970s strike?
To my knowledge, none.
Was there picketing down
here? No, there was no picketing out here. So you can have, this kind of thing can be successful only if you have reasonably widespread popular support.
Yeah. Well, among the students as well.
Among the students. Here, the public is the students. And they didn't. And we're isolated, and it's not a particular friendly. They may have picketed out here, but no one paid much attention to them. I think they picketed. I don't even remember.
Well, you said they had accomplished some valuable changes, the TA strike in 1970.
Yes, viewing it from the teaching assistant's viewpoint, I'm sure they would feel these are things are valuable, and there probably are practices which were brought to attention that that I certainly wouldn't support doing.
What?
There is a provision in the contract that guarantees a period of support for a graduate student once he is employed as a teaching assistant.
Oh, we did talk about that.
I think we talked about that. Mm-hmm. That to me is an important thing, and it attempted to address a problem which could have existed. I don't know to what extent it did.
Mm-hmm.
I think also the TAA focused attention on the problem of non-uniformity of workloads, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible for a teaching assistant to be working for a professor that assigns an unreasonable amount of work for the pay that the student is getting. These people really are graduate students, and if they are working 40 hours a week for a professor teaching and working on a course, they're not having very much time left to do their graduate studies.
Does this happen in the College of Engineering?
This is not. No, I don't think so. I don't think it happens very many places. But I can imagine that it, on occasion, did happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Maybe not 40 hours a week, but maybe some weeks 30 or more. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of time. And I think that the student could have gotten situations like this taken care of if he had gone to the department chairman, if he had just done it. But students are frequently working for this professor as a teaching assistant who is also their thesis supervisor, and so they're very reluctant to go and complain about a man who has a tremendous amount of control over their future careers, success.
Mm-hmm.
So there undoubtedly are occasional abuses of this type, and there may still be some going on, although I don't think. But now there is a formal mechanism for them to address this problem. Through the grievance procedure, and in such a way that they may feel that they're less at risk.
Yeah. Well, what would you have to say about the subsequent history of the TAA and the and negotiations, particularly last year? There was a comment in the Cardinal that after last year's failed strike, that this would be the end of the union.
I think it's a weak union. And it will probably stay a weak union. Unless in some unfortunate way there is something happens that is a serious abuse of the teaching assistants from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In which case they now have a mechanism of quickly drawing more people in and forming up a stronger group. There isn't much need for the union. People don't really want to do away with it. I don't see any reason to try to destroy it or to get rid of it or anything like that. And people don't have any desire to squeeze the last ounce of strength out of the teaching assistants or to get the wages down to the bare minimum and this kind of thing. People really are trying to deal in an equitable way, a reasonably straightforward, honest way.
I suppose they always thought they always were.
I think they always thought they were. That's right. And so unless something happens, like happened before, to form the teaching assistants union, I would expect the union to sort of go along as a organization. I don't see any indication that the chancellor doesn't want to deal with them and isn't happy to go ahead and do it. And so we'll probably have them for a long time. But I don't think it'll be a very strong, powerful group in most instances, unless there's some external force.
So in negotiations this year, you probably didn't regard as very crucial. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say that the negotiations could have been conducted in such a way that it would have provided a strong incentive for them to get more members and to build up a big organization to do this.
So here the negotiators...
You take care in this kind of thing. This is serious business.
You mean they were handled well?
Well, I guess I don't like the word handled.
All right.
Because I don't think we tried to handle them. I think we tried to deal with them as valued professional employees that were presenting their view, and we were presenting the university's view in what we felt was a honest, reasonable way to come to an agreement.
You did say if things, I've forgotten the words you used, things had gone differently, that there could have been...
Well, if we had treated this as a trivial matter, for instance, or if we had if we had really not bargained with them in good faith, then I think this could have resulted in them becoming sufficiently frustrated and angry that they would then have had reason to say, well, They don't think we're a reasonable union. We're not doing this well. We'll get their attention.
Yeah, I see. Well, if you have nothing further to say about the TAA,
there are lots of things you could talk about the teaching assistants and the negotiations, but I don't think of anything particularly outstanding.
You have been with it for a long time, so.
Yes, I've been interested to see the people come in and go and the changes and the kinds of things.
Because the women got much more involved later on, and that's been rather an important development, I think, at least for the TAA.
I thought this year the Teaching Assistants Association approached their negotiations in a much more appropriate way than they had in previous years. that in many instances in past years, they felt, it seemed to me that they were trying to use the negotiations as a forum to publicize their views rather than to accomplish anything which could be handled in a labor negotiation mm-hmm. session.
Now, Matthew Brin, is that right, was the president?
Matt Brin,
oh,
yes.
Mark First, how do you pronounce his name? He was one of the bargainers.
Mark First was one of them, yes.
Was this because of the people who were bargaining that you felt the approach was better, or?
Well, I think they just decided to do it differently.
Hmm.
I don't know why they did it, or what the change in their organization was, but they did have different people, some different people.
Mm-hmm.
But their approach was different, that's all.
And just this year? It isn't that it's
mainly this. There was a big change this year.
Huh. That's interesting. Ask Henry Heslock about that. Well, I'd like to ask you about the Institute for Environmental Studies, which has been, seems to have been a bone of contention around the whole university.
I think that people have had, people in engineering have had some trouble with the general group of courses which have the word environment in the title, kind of a philosophical problem, in that most people in engineering would define engineering as the use of scientific principles to solve problems for mankind. They don't regard engineering as the study of science, but rather the application of science to solving real problems. So most of us have felt that what we were doing was dealing with the environment.
All along.
Yes, this is mm-hmm. not new.
Mm-hmm.
I went into engineering practice in 1949. Working for a company that made a large number of toxic materials. And one of the concerns of our company was that no one get hurt. Now that meant no one in the plant, none of our neighbors, and none of the children who might pick up some empty bottles in a trash pile or anything else. That this was a company that felt total responsibility to make sure that hazardous materials were properly handled. So the idea of dealing adequately with the environment was not a new concept to me when the environmentalists came along. And certainly the dumping of untreated sewage into water courses had been going on for a great many years, and it was very important that this be changed. But this didn't seem to me to be something which you make a total study of, and the study of the environment. So when it comes to talking about environmental studies or environmental courses of one type and another, you get troubled because people then becomes expert in, or are given the impression that they are expert in dealing with problems of the environment, where most of the environmental solutions are either political and economically related, or they involve engineering. Now, the engineering technology to solve the treatment of sewage or the treatment of industrial waste or the elimination of plumes from sulfur dioxide from plumes and so on, are engineering problems which are related with what people are willing to pay for, what they're really willing to do, so that most of these problems will not benefit from training people in how to, in what the problem is, in studying the problems. And so you get troubled about, well, what are these people going to do, and where are they going to work, and what are they going to be really trained for? I guess I liken this to the difference between taking a course in music appreciation and taking a course in performance.
Mm-hmm.
Music appreciation is a fine thing to have, and I think people ought to have some appreciation of these things. But if you're going to have anybody that plays in an orchestra and does anything with music, he's got to study it a little more deeply. And I think the same thing occurs with engineering and environmental courses. I am somewhat inclined to put in the viewpoint of a kind of an appreciation of engineering instead of a study of engineering. Now,
well,
this is a little bit aside. This is the kind of a philosophical problem that I think engineers have had with some of the very soft sort of courses which have been offered under the title of environmental studies or environmental engineering.
Do you know that this is, I suppose you do, that this is what the geographers say, that in fact what is being done is what they do? And
no, I didn't really know this.
This is I think I'm going to stop the tape here. This is the second tape of the interview with Dean Camden Coberly.
Now, this was a matter of background as to explain why I feel that engineers kind of react negatively to this environmental course. Now, this didn't say that that's the right way to react, or that there isn't a reason for courses in environmental studies, because obviously you can look at things which are being done which do not take into account a broad enough sphere of activities. You know, my experience with this particular company may not have been at all typical. As to what was going on, because there are still companies which dump things in the river and don't worry about it at all. And there are state highway departments which locate highways by starting at this point and going as straight as possible in the direction they want to go in. And you can look at people who design projects from a particular narrow purpose without regarding the total overall pattern. So there was a lack of broad enough analysis of the results of particular projects or problems and this kind of thing. And there also was no way in which a person could reasonably understand all of these things. So there was a kind of a void. And I think that things like the Institute for Environmental Studies came into that void.
But could the College of Engineering have filled the void itself?
Well, I rather doubt that it could have, because it couldn't have gotten people to come and study in that area. You know, if you're talking about what does a college do, a college works, or a university works on very long range. We train students to think, and then those students eventually get out and they eventually move on up to where they have some influence. So there were lots of things which had to be done outside which can't be handled by the university. Now, the Institute for Environmental Studies here was set up to try to pull together a cross-discipline sort of program to feed information in from various areas so that people in the various departments did recognize what was being contributed by other people. And so it's a good idea. It's a good idea to have interdisciplinary studies. But when you do this, you immediately run into the difficulty that people are trained very broadly and in relatively surface ways because of the breadth of their training, so that they may not be equipped to do anything well.
Now, do you have engineers who are taking a minor in the Institute?
We don't really do that. You do not have, as an undergraduate, have a minor. You can select electives from any area you want, and we may have some people who are taking...
But just one or two courses?
Courses in Institute for Environmental Studies. We have joint appointments with people in engineering who are faculty who have appointments in the Institute for Environmental Studies.
Now, was there objection to that, faculty meetings?
No objection to that. No problems with that. The difficulty, I think, that arose about the Institute for Environmental Studies was when it started to assume the aspects of a college organizationally, in which it was going to be, in essence, it was going to function as a college, making tenure appointments, operating with a director reporting to the chancellor, not through any of the academic teams. And so people then became concerned that courses of study would be developed which would duplicate those which were already existing. And no one knew exactly what the body of knowledge was which was going to be assembled into a department which was conceivably an interdisciplinary type thing, which then was to become a discipline.
Yes, yeah.
And so you have problems of knowing, well, is this a discipline? And if it is a discipline, what is it? And so as long as it remained an interdisciplinary program drawing from existing well-established disciplines based on a science or a particular study and served an integrating and cross-linking function, I don't think there's too much trouble with it. But when it becomes a discipline in itself, it, in many instances, has so little quantitative content that engineers are troubled by it. Philosophically troubled. Mm-hmm. Well, what are the people going to do? Mm-hmm. And who are going to solve the problems? And what we have tried to do, I think, is to just make people that we are graduating more generally aware of the broader impact of their work and of the work that they will be doing later.
You mean
as a response to the problems that society now has. You know, make a civil engineer think, well, gee, if I'm locating this highway, I should really think about what I do to wetlands. And
in other words, you're saying this is the function that the Institute was taking on itself, but we can do some of that here.
Well, I don't know whether the Institute was taking that on or not.
That must be. It's really a political philosophy,
yes,
the Institute.
I think what we are going to train engineers. The Institute's not going to train engineers.
Yeah. But you're going to take some of what they have in mind and...
I think the programs have been broadened out in the college. But I don't know whether it was because of the Institute or just because of the general awareness of the faculty of the college that this is what's needed.
I was going to ask you whether there would have been a division among those who would put the environment first. Well, were any of the Army Corps of Engineers trained here?
Well, of course. course, and Professor Arno Lanz, who used to be chairman of civil engineering, is now retired, was an advisor and worked with the Army Corps of Engineers for many years, dams. The Corps of Engineers has a goal which is established by federal law. They have a function, what their function is. And I don't think they just proceed ahead on a particular course of action in a way that is unresponsive to their instructions from the Congress.
Well, we better not debate.
I really don't. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem, this is a political problem.
Oh, you're saying it's Congress.
This is a political problem, yeah, as to what they are. For instance, there's a conflict now over changing the locks on the Alton Dam. It's just north of St. Louis, the Alton Dam on the Mississippi River. And you could say, well, the Corps of Engineers is disregarding the environment, and they want to deepen the locks, and that will result in these great big barges going up and down the Mississippi River, and the environmentally oriented people in the area are taking them to court and having public hearings and all the rest of this. And on the other hand, I can say the cheapest way to get coal up and down the Mississippi River, which we need to do very badly, is by barge, that this uses less energy and will have less adverse impact on the environment than hauling it by truck. And so this is a matter of, you see, there's two sides to this kind of thing. And it is not a matter of engineering to decide this. This is a matter of politics and public policy as to whether or not we're going to develop our rivers and to what extent we're going to develop our rivers for barge travel and what extent we're going to develop some other method of transportation, be it railroads or trucks or airplanes or whatever it is. And so this is not a matter of one group being against the Corps of Engineers and the Corps of Engineers being against another. This is a matter of the people of the country instructing, listening to the pros and cons, and instructing their representatives in Congress to establish a policy for the country as to how to go ahead. So I don't see this as a conflict for engineers.
In that way, engineers are acting like scientists, in that they have a body of skills.
They have a body of skills which they can say, this is the way certain problems can be. These are alternative solutions to this particular problem. And we do not have the expertise, the all-powered, all-seeing expertise to tell the people, this is the way the people have to decide for themselves what they are going to do, what they're not going to do. This is a...
Yeah. I'm just thinking of your earlier remark that engineering did have as part of its goal the...
solving problems for the
good of humanity. Yeah.
I don't think this is irresponsible. I think this is a response to this kind of... I think the Corps of Engineers, just as I think many state highway departments, have been rather high-handed in some of these things.
Yes.
But this is the result of our failing to recognize and failing to be willing in political bodies to failing to recognize the long time that is required to do certain things, and failing to commit ourselves to long-term programs. All of our legislative structure is on very short-range kind of things.
Sort of trouble the university has with it, isn't it, that it's on a short-range legislative budget.
Oh, yeah. all of our society is very much hampered by this.
Well, could I just ask you, in chemical engineering, which after all is one of the most crucial, it must be, the spray cans and things like that. Mm-hmm. What is the philosophy of the faculty in the chemical engineering department? Do they try to instill ideas about protection of environment?
I think so. No, I think that this is the importance of responsibly dealing with problems of all kinds of this sort are very much dealt with.
This would depend very much on the individuals, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes.
On the faculty.
Oh, sure. Some people are more interested in this kind of thing. Well, you look at Professor Chapman, who made a very important contribution to cleaning up the Wisconsin River through finding out where mercury was getting into it. Mm-hmm. He's made a lot of contributions in that. He has a project which is working on a new method of getting copper ore out of sulfide ores, which will make it unnecessary to roast it and get sulfur dioxide out. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work. Professor Kowski has had some projects in recycling of tires, and trying to figure out how to use the material and do this sort of mm-hmm. thing. So there's, and in addition to that, I think that that there is a fair amount of all of this in the courses. Mm-hmm. Brought in to what you do, you have to treat the waste from industrial processes, you have to be sure of the safety of the process, and I put handling toxic materials as a part of safety. Mm-hmm. See, the chemical industry in this country for many years, for decades, has had the best safety record of any industry group in the United States.
That's very much to its credit.
Well, it's you know, an order of magnitude lower lost time accident record than any other industry. And you can say that part of this is due to the inherent nature of the industry, but if you consider the kinds of materials which are handled in the chemical industry, this is not necessarily true. It's I think instead it's been due to the thoughtfulness of the designers, of the people who did it, and the management of this industry, the executive management of this industry, which decided to do it. Companies like DuPont, for instance, are leaders in this as far as safety records are concerned.
Is there something else that we should be saying about the Institute?
No, I guess I haven't.
It's developing, you know, a program of undergraduate, trying to develop an undergraduate major now.
It'll be interesting to see how this turns out. Uh-huh. I can have prejudices about this. I wouldn't say that I have any great answers to the whole thing. I would hope that that people look at these things, that students look at these things honestly, and that they are presented an honest picture. Engineers don't have any trouble finding work.
No.
Because they can work. Most of the people that are working in environmental activities are not people that have been trained in environmental studies courses. they're people that have been trained in engineering, because you have to have hard knowledge and hard facts. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you whether you're, well, you did talk about students and more women. I wanted to ask you if you were not getting a different type of student now, or people who were politically in coming into engineering because they not for the science of it, but in order to get the tool to.
We have a large number of women that are coming into it because they see this, I think, as an interesting career and overcoming the prejudices about women in this kind of an occupation.
But idealists who want to do help the environment.
I think engineers were always idealists.
Okay.
See, I don't think there's any difference about that. We are getting a fair number of students transferring from other disciplines into engineering.
But you think that's
because
of jobs.
And I think this is because they see this as a... Because all students seem to be more occupation, job, profession, or career-oriented now.
Yeah, we did talk about this earlier.
And so I think this is happening in engineering, too.
Well, let's move briefly to the Institute for Technology in Surabaya, where you've just been for 3 weeks. Why is the University of Wisconsin involved, and who is paying for it?
Well, we're involved in this because we have some faculty members that want to do it. It's really that simple. That we don't find in administration, don't find projects and tell faculty you ought to be involved in this.
But Ford Foundation doesn't come to you and say, would you do this?
We were not approached by Ford Foundation or anybody else. Professor Carbon, through his interest in this particular area and through a project he had, found out that I don't know exactly how I did find out that there was an institute in Surabaya, a technical institute in Surabaya, that was considering improving itself. Eastern Java is expanding rapidly.
There's a big center in Bandung. I know the Ite Bay in Bandung is
Surabaya is the industrial city, second largest city in Java, and it is the center of the industrial expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Java, the governor of Eastern Java a year ago received a prize for the greatest promotion of industry in his area, greatest development. The Indonesians are interested in developing their country, and they're trying to do something about it. One of their problems is that they have a shortage of engineers. And the Technical Institute of Surabaya is a large engineering school. It has about 3,000 students. It's spread out on several campuses. Each department is in a different location. And they decided that they wanted to improve this. In order to do it, they wanted to establish a single campus and draw all their faculty together. They wanted to find a way in which they could get, and I say they because this was the Indonesians that wanted to do this. They saw this as their problem. They wanted to get people through their school more rapidly. The engineers, many of them were never finishing. A very slow output, poor efficiency. Some of them take 6 or more years to graduate. And so they obtained funds from the Asian Development Bank in Manila to run a preliminary study and the Asian of what could be done, the feasibility study of what should be done in this institute. Now the Asian Development Bank asked various institutions, would you be interested in doing this? And our institution was selected.
In the United States or in other countries as well?
They inquired of I don't know where all they got bids, but I would expect that they would get them from, there was at least one English university that proposed to do this feasibility study. And but Wisconsin was selected to do it. And Wisconsin then got the entire job of, and they subcontracted a part of it to an architectural firm, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then some professors here went under the direction of Professor Carbon.
Who was in charge of
the study?
Getting the bid and subcontracting?
Professor Carbon.
The whole, I see.
He Wisconsin had it, and he was the project director of Professor Max Carbon. And so we made a study which resulted in a, an inch thick report to the Asian Development Bank as to whether it was feasible for the, and this was a report to the bank, paid for by the bank entirely.
How long ago did this begin?
Oh, a year and a half or more ago.
Did you have to get the chancellor's approval to go
into
this?
Sure. This is a, just like any university contract.
And you must have somebody up in the chancellor's office who...
Well, it has to be approved by the regents. But this goes as a proposal. It goes through research administration, actually. And there's an office there that looks at this. You don't enter into these things without the chancellor's knowledge, of course.
Who is he? Is that David Johnson's field?
Oh, he was involved in it, I'm sure. But we submitted through research administration from our college. It was a proposal from our college. And so they made the study. We had people over there a couple of times. And this was a report to the bank which said, this institute has the capability to becoming a first-class school of engineering, in essence. It should do certain things, and it will cost this amount. That's, what it is. Then on the basis of that report, the bank decided to lend the Indonesian government, and on the request of the Indonesian government, made to make a loan application, the bank then approved a loan to carry out this improvement of this university, or this technical institute, this school. Now, the total program involves funds from the bank of, as I recall, about $25 million international exchange, as dollar money.
Is this an American-funded bank, or... Well, we shouldn't get into that probably.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about the Asian Development Bank. The Asian Development Bank is funded by donations from the developed countries. Like U.S. puts money into it, Australia, Japan, contributions from all of these form a fund. Mm-hmm. Which is then loaned at interest.
Yeah, I see.
To countries which want to borrow foreign exchange, and the Indonesian government borrows the money at 8 2/3% or whatever they have to pay, and then after a period they pay it off. They have to pay it back.
Yeah.
So this is a, in a sense, a revolving fund type thing, like. And it operates, it's located in Manila, its office is in Manila, and it operates in Asia.
Yeah. Okay. Go on.
And so that's where it gets its money from. Some of it comes from, I suppose, U.S. aid programs to the bank. But it's, but that's just the source of the capital, and then it has to be paid back. Mm-hmm. They make lots of different kinds of loans like this.
Yeah.
Or development loans, you know. Well, the Indonesian government then has to put in money, which they will put in local currency, Indonesian currency, and build buildings and the rest of it. So then the Indonesian government requested bids or proposals from institutions of higher education with engineering schools, and also from architectural firms. Mm-hmm. And we had some faculty people who wanted to do this. And so they prepared a proposal, which was reviewed through the usual university procedures and submitted to the director of the institute, Technical Institute Sarabhaya Project, who's also the rector of the institute, a man named Zaki. And they reviewed their proposals and selected Wisconsin as the number two, selected Stanford University. They also selected an architectural firm because they're going to build a new campus, develop a new campus, and work with an architectural firm. And then they'll have an academic institution as a linkage institution to provide advice in the academic area, to help them tell the architect how to design, how big to make it, this sort of thing. And also they are going to send their faculty people to overseas institutions for training, upgrading. So they're going to upgrade their faculty. And they wanted someone to administer the program of the fellowships, faculty fellowships programs for the Indonesians. So this is an Indonesian program controlled by the Indonesians for one of their institutions, and the Indonesian government will write a contract with an architectural firm for the buildings, and they will write a contract with us for the academic linkage concern.
And some of your faculty
they will probably not teach in the usual sense, but they will work with the faculty there in developing new programs, new teaching methods, new courses, and advising on the establishing laboratories and building facilities, provide the information about this. They will no doubt give lectures and seminars, but we will be working more with their faculty than we will with their students. Most of their students don't know English or aren't fluent in English, and so we're not really going to be just providing them teaching. We don't have that much input into it. It's a 4-year program, and we hope to get it started early in 1977 and finish it by the end of 1980.
Do you expect to be further involved than you have been?
I am scheduled to go out there for a 2-month period early in the program to assist with setting it up and also to provide advice in academic administration.
I've heard it said that the University of Wisconsin's enormous involvement in Indonesia, and it is very big. It all has something to do with the CIA.
I don't know what it would have. I've certainly never talked to anybody about CIA. I don't think any CIA people have talked to any of the group. That's, of course, always always suggested kind of a popular thing. There have been occasions when I know that scientific missions, visitors going to Russia and places like that, were approached by the CIA before they left. This was not here at Wisconsin. This years ago, before I ever came here, I had friends that were members of some of the first scientific visiting teams that went into Russia. You know, this is in the 50s, when we had little, if any, information about those countries. And they were interested in trying to get CIA people were interested in trying to assess the general technology level in the Russian scientific institutes, the schools that these people were visiting. And so when a visitor would go to, into Russia for this kind of thing, I think they were asked after they came back to comment on what they had seen, you know, just like any visitor might be when he goes to another place. But we don't have any money from any sources except the Indonesians, actually, in this. And they get their money, they get their foreign exchange from their Asian Development Bank loan. No, it's a pretty straightforward, I suppose, altruistic kind of motive on part of the faculty that are involved in it. This is a, we were there for less than 3 weeks. We were only about 10 in it. In Sarabaya. So you get the impression of the people that you meet. They're very cheerful, friendly, enthusiastic, hardworking, nice people to work with. They have a lot of problems in developing their institute. They're very interested in doing it. It's an opportunity to work with them and an exciting project to learn, maybe make a contribution to the development of a country that in a way that will make some lasting friends, or just have an exciting kind of thing. It's an opportunity, as I see it, for the faculty that go to broaden themselves, to learn something, to have an experience of working in an institutional development program, seeing the problems of planning and organizing and developing this kind of thing in a very short period of time. It's really valuable experience for someone going to stay in education in this country.
Yes.
And it's a broadening experience. So it's, in that sense, I think it contributes to the professional development of the faculty, people that participate. And most of the people, or a good many of the people, are younger faculty.
And departments are always, it's always quite a good thing to have a few people going off. It helps the budget.
We'll have some, well, not that so much, but we'll have some people coming in the other direction. And our graduate program is good because, actually, it's an outstanding graduate program because we get outstanding students as much as for any other reason. So you have to have interaction with other places if you're going to continue to get good students.
Yes.
And we'll get some good students from there in time.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? I know you're in charge, I believe, of the engineering research. What is the title?
I'm in charge of the engineering experiment station.
Yes, the engineering. Which
this is really our administrative structure for research and graduate programs in the College of Engineering.
You hand out you're responsible for allocating funds and accepting research projects, isn't that right? That deciding who should get what.
Well, research projects come into the college because of proposals written by the faculty. I don't go out, for instance, to get research money.
No, but I mean, of those that come in, you decide among them.
We provide, once a principal investigator gets a research project, it's his project, and he decides how he's going to spend the money. We do have, in our college, in the experiment station, some small amount of state funds, which is really just provides a base for the rest of the funding. And we work to try to allocate this among the programs to help the departments get things started. This is pretty much faculty control all the way through. See, it's hard to explain administration in our university to someone who hasn't been involved in it carefully, because you think of the dean or the chancellor, the president, as being the one who directs things, controls where it goes and how it operates. But it really isn't that way. This is an institution which is controlled and governed by the faculty. That's the reason you asked me, why are we in Sarabhaisa? Because we have some faculty people that wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have some faculty people that wanted to do it, not only would we not do it, but we couldn't do it, because we wouldn't have anybody to do the work.
Yeah.
And so it's the same way with research. We're involved in research projects because we have some, not only people who want to do it, but people who can have sufficient stature and sufficiently good ideas that they can get funds to do it. Because we couldn't do very much research if we didn't have outside funds.
Would you accept the definition of administration in a university, which is Jacques Barzon's, as being one of distributing the resources to the best advantage of everyone? Do you think that would cover the...
No, I don't define it that way. We have some resources which we allocate, and we have some control through, some long-term control through budgeting and through the hiring of people and influencing the hiring of people. But mainly our function is to facilitate the faculty achieving its goals. We help people do what they want to do.
I guess that is different.
And I really believe that's the way we operate. We have people that submit proposals to the National Science Foundation. And we have in our engineering experiment station some people who have spent many years learning and keeping in touch with people in the National Science Foundation. And so when we submit a proposal, a professor's proposal to the National Science Foundation, we're reasonably confident it gets submitted the right way, mm-hmm. to the right people. And if it gets turned down, we can find out why. Mm-hmm. And we can provide advice to that man as to why his proposal was rejected. And if he then chooses to use that advice and rewrite it and submit it again, he has a better chance than if he didn't do it. When we get a new organization in Washington like IRDA, where everything is all scrambled upside down and nobody even down there knows what's going on, we start again to study that organization, yeah. and to figure out how to do that. So, in a sense, we do have, an important role, but it would be of no value whatsoever if we did not have a faculty that was interested in doing research and was very competent, able to do this work and to write proposals, and if they mm-hmm. did it. So it's, but really we're more in the role of facilitating the efforts of the faculty than
yes,
we are in allocating mm-hmm. resources. We don't have resources to allocate. The faculty get the resources.
Oh, well, faculty is one of the resources.
yeah, but the allocation
space
there was made long ago. Yeah. Space, somewhat. Yeah. But, you know, after you have a certain number of people and a certain number of offices, what are you going to do? What is the allocation problem?
You know, incidentally, I was thinking that Dean DeRima, he's associate dean,
yes.
as you are, I believe.
Yes.
Three of his offices, I think, would fit in yours.
Would they?
Yes.
Well, I don't think it's quite like that, but...
I guess that's just a matter of chance, isn't it?
You know, there's a university standard which was established before this building was built on how large offices are to be.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think this office was designed the way it should be. As a matter of fact, I was involved in designing the offices on this floor of this building. And this office is not designed the way I drew it on the drawing.
Huh.
I had this wall on this column line because I thought that space ought to be out where the secretary would have all the files and where the space would be more useful. And this office is bigger than it needs to be.
Yeah.
But they have a rule, you know, about the director of a program is supposed to have so many square feet of office.
Is this a university
and
rule,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah,
I see.
Construction and planning have this.
And so that's very interesting.
And it's related to the whole building's design is related to this certain size cubicles so that they get it between column lines. And really this is two offices wide as compared with out to that column plus that little plus one window more. And really it would have been just as useful to have it right there.
Yeah.
And we'd have, but they decided this is the director of the engineering research studies, so this office must be larger than any other office in the
building. For behaving like that.
So it's it's really kind of ridiculous. But I use this end of it as a conference room.
I suppose you do have, since you have the space, you would have the conferences here.
Lots of my activity involves just talking to groups of three or four people. And so we do that instead of going to a conference room.
Yeah.
I was just out at Stanford University last week on an engineering accreditation. I was one of the outside visitors to go. I went through their new chemistry building, which they're just getting ready to occupy, just finishing it. And I was really surprised at the size of the professor's offices in this building.
Big or little?
Much larger than anything we would have.
Huh.
And it's a new building. It also looked like a building that was designed before we were so conscious of the cost of energy because it's going to be a high energy user.
Yes, they had to cool it there, don't they? Rather than
well, they shouldn't have to, but they have it all enclosed, so they'll have to.
No.
Do that.
No.
This kind of, this kind of thing is kind of interesting.
Do you do that very often? Go out on accrediting trips?
Not very often. There are a lot of people involved in it so that each individual isn't asked too often. Mm-hmm. I've been twice this year. It'd probably be all that I will make.
You know, we seem to be at the end of the interview, yet I didn't ask you if you have served on other committees in the university. I have a list of committees you've been on, but most of them seem to have to do with engineering, but it may be an old list. Have you been on any all university committees aside from the TAA?
Oh, I've served on the Honorary Degrees Committee. I'm on the University Industry Relation or University Industry Research Program Advisory Committee. I'm on the Physical Sciences Advisory Committee. Physical Sciences Laboratory Advisory Committee. Used to be on the University Space Sciences and Engineering Committee. I chaired our ad hoc committee, Chancellor's Committee on Educational Satellite Program.
Hmm.
I'm on the All University Ocean geography.
Yes, sir, that's, that was
on. Engineering mm-hmm. committee. I was on the research committee for 4 years, which is an all-university committee.
The research committee? The
research committee.
I don't know enough about that yet to ask you anything.
No, it's
that,
it's the committee in the graduate school. It's an advisory to the dean of the graduate school, which allocates the funds which come from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation.
I see.
This is university-wide, yeah. Or campus-wide.
Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of money to deal with.
That's about well over $3 million a year, usually.
How long a term do you serve on that committee?
Normally it's 3 years. Mm-hmm. I've served 4 years.
Oh. It's not an automatically rotating off.
But usually people are on it about 3 years. No. Mm. No, it's appointed by the dean of graduate school. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've been on any others or not. Outside the college. That's probably most of them. You know, it's hard to remember these. Some of them are short time, and some of them are longer.
Well, perhaps we should stop here. You've given me a lot of time.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you.